This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Welcome to Dreamland. As always, I'm excited. I'm excited every week, or I wouldn't be doing this. I'm excited every week because it's really a fun thing to be doing. The guest and I were just talking just before the show about the fact that both of us have been involved with UFOs for a long time. And the reason being, this is probably the most extraordinary and interesting subject in the world. And one of the most interesting people involved in that subject is none other than Robert Powell, who's got a new book out about UFOs, and we're going to be talking about that. But Robert is he's been involved in UFO research for 16 years, it says here. And since I'm a fabulous mathematician, I'm guessing that was just about 16 years ago, whenever that was. Robert, welcome to Dreamland. I'm glad to have you on the show.
Hi, Whitley. It's good to be on your show again. And it's actually been 17 years now, because it was 16 years when I wrote the book. And you know, there's a little time delay before it's published.
Right.
So now I'm at 17 years in the subject.
Another UFO book. What makes it different?
So the difference to me in this book is I explain why I believe the UFO phenomenon is real. And so what I do in the book is I give reasons why, number one, it's a physical reality. It's not a figment of people's imagination. And number two, whatever it is far in advance of us, and it demonstrates intelligence and technological capability. And I go into the book and explain how I draw those conclusions. And I make it as scientific as possible. So for those who like numbers, they can try to come to the same conclusion that I come to. Or not.
Or not, yeah. Well, you know, the thing about the phenomenon is that you emphasize its physicality. And that immediately brings up a question of it's kind of on a shadow line between the physical and the non-physical. I mean, like when we had people up at our cabin, routinely people would see their dead friends and relatives along with the physical beings in the phenomenon. It was, you know, you could often have a situation where in one room there were people experiencing physical contact with a physical being, and in another room, a dead relative was there. So what in the world is going on there? Do you have any idea? Because I'm torn between the idea that the dead really exist in this context, and that there's something that these beings are so good at doing stuff to your mind. I mean, they can bake your head real fast.
Yeah.
So just talk to that a little bit.
So, you know, there are, my personal view is that there is more than just one UFO phenomenon per se. In other words, I don't believe this is of just one origin. And I don't know the origin, but I believe there's more than one origin. And when you said, Whitley, you know, how it kind of does things with your head, there's a lot of that in different aspects. I'll give you one example. I interviewed a husband and wife. The husband's a forest ranger, and the wife was a math teacher. And every morning they would get up at about 5 a.m. and she would have fixed him coffee. And then they, you know, she gives him a kiss goodbye and off they go. And, you know, leaves every morning, same time. And both of them enjoy looking at the stars. One morning, the same routine's going on. And, you know, the stars are out because this is around 4 to 5 in the morning. He looks up at the stars and he's looking at the Orion constellation. And one of the stars in Orion is Rigel. And both the husband and wife are, you know, good amateur astronomers, and they know the names of those stars, know where they're at, they know the constellations. And as he's looking at Rigel, it suddenly brightens 2 to 3 times its normal brightness. And his wife sees it, and, you know, they're discussing how can that be? Because Rigel's not a variable star, you know, it's no indication it should be going supernova or anything. So what's going on? Well, they don't figure it out. She goes, she gets ready to do something else. She turns, and he's looking at it. And then all of a sudden, the star dims back to its normal brightness, and this little UFO, UAP, whatever you want to call it, starts to revolve around Rigel. And then it goes away. And to him, it was almost like it was saying, hey, look, I'm, you know, you can know I'm here because I'm revolving around this star, right? And it's doing things it should not do. So if you think about it, for that to happen, whatever this object was, if it moved in front of Rigel and brightened itself, right, to make it look like Rigel brightened, then that means it was doing this for this particular witness, right? Because they have to align with each other. And so someone 2 miles away would not see that happen. It only could happen to this individual and his wife who are looking at it. And so that's an example, one example of how it deals with your mind.
You know, it reminds me of a gentleman now, a dear friend now, sadly passed to the great beyond, called John Gleidman. And John was a physicist and I believe also a psychologist, a very brilliant man. And when the communion experience hit, he and I worked together a lot on what else could it be, anything but what it seemed to be. That was our basic approach. And we even considered the idea that the sound of the refrigerator in the house had triggered some kind of hallucinatory effect. We really went deep. However, what happened was that John proceeds. He is also an amateur astronomer with scopes and pretty seriously into it. And we're outside and he says, wait a minute, look at that star. That star. I said, what star? He said, because I'm not an astronomer at all. And he says, there's a star underneath the moon that shouldn't be there. I said, how do you know? He said, because I know the sky and there's that an extra star. Whereupon, as if on command, it proceeds to go around the moon, return to its original place and disappear. And then we changed our approach entirely to the question of what had happened to me.
Right. Yeah.
It's such cool stuff. I mean, you know, why do you think it chose these people to do this with?
That, you know, that's the $64,000 question. Why did it choose these particular people? Clearly, I've never been chosen. So, you know, I've never even seen a UFO.
Yeah, that's fascinating because, you know, why did you choose yourself to do this? I'm going to ask that question.
Well, because when I was a teenager, I read J. Allen Hynek's book, The UFO Experience. Yeah. And, you know, it's written in kind of a science type mode. And I enjoyed the book. And of course, life gets in the way, right? You go to college, you get married, you have a family. And I was able to retire early. And so I went back to remembering, you know, that book because I kept it all those years. And I said, I want to go back and look at this again. And at that point in time, I didn't have an opinion one way or another about UFOs. So I began studying the subject. And the more I studied it, the more it became apparent to me that there's a reality to this. And even though I've never seen a true UFO myself, this allowed me to, you know, to really get involved in the subject. And I've been in it ever since for the last 17 years. Now, one thing that I I did want to mention, Whitley, you know, when we were talking about how this gets into your head, for example. So one thing I've contemplated on abductions, and let me say right from the beginning that I am not an expert in abductions. That's not my area. But when you're in the field for 17 years, you run across a lot of people who have had an abduction and talk to you about it.
Robert, we're going to take a brief break, and this is a good time to do it. And when we get back, folks, we're going to be talking about abductions. We'll be right back. We're talking to Robert Powell. His new book, UFOs, The Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know About UFOs. I got the title right?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. Before we left the air, we were getting ready to talk about abductions. And this is not your field of your wheelhouse, but you've still got some ideas because you've probably met a lot of people like me who have had abduction experiences.
Right. And I've had people, you know, that tell me an abduction, their experience and story. And some people, you know, you're not sure you believe them. But then there's other people that tell you the story. And it's like, wow, I can't believe, I mean, this certainly sounds, he sounds very honest and straightforward. He's not trying to get attention, or she, whichever it happens to be. And so one thought I've had is, what if the abduction happens only in the witness's mind? And by that, I don't mean the witness has a psychological episode. I mean another entity, wherever that entity is. I mean, it could be, for all I know, it could be 50,000 light years away. But it puts the exact experience into the person's mind. And as far as that person's concerned, it happened. And there's no way, if it happened to me, there's no way I could discern between that and reality, because reality is what we experience in our minds. So that's one possibility I've thought about, Whitley, is, you know, could that be the case? Could it be manipulation of our mind?
Well, I think that to an extent must be the case, because in my situation, I mean, I've been doing this and had multiple encounters with the visitors over now a period of 30 years. And they range in very complicated ways from things I would say were definitely physical experiences because there were physical consequences to things that are much more like what you're describing and suggesting. For example, the first experience I was injured badly. I was raped. And I struggled with the pain from that and was under periodic medical treatment for it for 20 years because of the scar tissue. And that was real. Something happened. But here's the thing. And I get back to John Gleibman. We discussed this endlessly. Yes, I was raped, no question. But was I raped by what I saw? Or was there something else going on? Now, to expand on that a little bit, a year after the experience and after Communion had been published, probably a little more than a year, therefore, a friend came over. He was a state trooper, a retired state trooper, and proceeded to tell me that he had seen it happen to me. He had been coming home that night at 2 o'clock in the morning with his wife from a party and seen what he thought was a crashed blimp in a field near our houses. And he got out of his car to try to see if he could help. And when he walked toward it, lights came on all over it, started making a growling noise and came toward him very menacingly. And of course, his wife back in the car freaked out completely. And it's understandably so at 2 o'clock in the morning with that happening. And he did too. And he jumped in the car and they drove away. And he said to me, Whitley, I think you were the one, and I could hear someone screaming in there. I think it was you. And I just want to apologize that I didn't try to help you. I said to him, Wayne, you're very lucky that you didn't go down there, because God only knows what would have happened to you. But here's the thing. This all adds up to a physical experience, almost undeniably. And, you know, I can massage it all I want to, but the bottom line is physical injuries, and a friend saw it happen. So where do we take that?
I don't know. I mean, could it be that same scene was put into his head, right, by an outside force?
The answer is yes. And that's what makes it so endlessly fascinating. You know, David Grusch, in his testimony, alluded to the fact that we have bodies. We possess bodies, physical bodies of visitors. And, I don't think I'm talking out of court. I don't have a security clearance. I've heard the same thing, that we do possess three bodies, and they are at Fort Detrick in Maryland. And therefore, the question becomes, what in the world could that be about? Where could they be from? Because you look at everything we understand about this universe, and if they're from the same physical universe we're in, how in the name of God did they get here?
Well, yeah, they for them to have gotten here, they, in assuming they're from another planet around a different star, they either traveled at near light speed or they traveled faster than light in order to get here. It has to be one of those two possibilities.
Yeah, near light speed has a lot of problems. Like, the exponential increase in mass is tremendous. In other words, folks, the faster you go, the heavier you get. And it gets to a point when you're basically, it would be noticeable in the universe if something reached like 99% of the speed of light. It doesn't happen that physical objects go that fast. So is there a way to go beyond that? Well, here's the problem with, a wormhole. Well, yeah, but you think of the universe as a big, thick piece of steel, very thick. To make a wormhole, you have to bend the entire thing. And what does that tell you? It tells you, excuse me for getting off camera, I apologize. It tells you that the amount of energy necessary to create a wormhole must be greater than the entire energy of the universe. So that seems to be an unlikely way of getting around also. Unless there's a way of getting around that we don't know, and that's possible, I suppose, they can't have come here. And I just find that, I find this conundrum fascinating, because I won't say you're wrong that it's not all in the head, and I won't say that the injuries weren't caused in some other way. But then I ask the question, why would they be doing this? Because they get nowhere. This thing is just knocking along the same way it has been for years. If you go back to the NICAP days, we were just about ready to do this. Roscoe Hill Encoder was sitting in front of Congress saying it's time for this to all come out, years and years ago. And now we're doing the same thing, and the DOD is resisting in exactly the same way it did before. The Arrow report is a retread of Project Blue Book. I think it's almost a cut and paste job. So where are we with this? Robert, I mean, we're in some kind of a maze of mirrors that we can't get out of.
Well, we've spent 80 years with the military trying to resolve this, right? And that's one of the things I point out in my book. I think it's time to give up on the military trying to come up with a solution to UFOs and turn instead to academia. Because the big difference between those two groups, because the military does have access to, university professors and very intelligent people, but everything is closed. It's a closed system that you don't let others into it. But with academia, it's an open system, And that's the entire concept, to share your data. Like with Aero, we've never seen the data that makes up those reports that they show, the charts that they show. That data you don't get to see. You only get to see the results. And that's why we need to change. And with academia, you could get to see the data. And I think that's critical to making progress.
Well, the academic approach is fundamentally different from the scientific approach. You know, my friend Jeff Kripal would love what you're saying, because he would agree with you entirely. And I think there's a lot of substance in this idea, because what would be different if academia was leading the charge here?
So if academia is leading the charge, then you initially you have to provide them funding, right, to make it happen. So
that's
assuming
right.
You've done that and they're leading the charge, you bring in the younger generations and you take data and conclusions that have been driven, and then other people look at those and then they say, well, maybe that's right, but not this part of it. And they try to review the work you've done and duplicate that work. So I think it's important that all the cards are out on the table, because as long as let me back up. Let's say if you assume we're dealing with something much more intelligent than ourselves, it's going to be very difficult to make headway. And then to make headway, you're not even providing all the information to the sharpest people, you know, on the planet that can work on this, then you might as well not even try, which is where we're at today. So I think we should at least try and provide all the information and see if we can come up with, you know, some kind of answers to what we are dealing with.
Because we're not there, not even close to answers. And we've been struggling with this for years and years, and yet you and I still have to sit here and talk about whether or not it's even real in the physical sense. And that's a serious issue. Even to a guy who's been beat up by it plenty of times, not just the one time, but I've had them in my life many times. And they look physical quite often, not always, but quite often. They've even, you know, they fool with my body every once in a while. And I can't disagree with you, though. I don't think that I have any final, I guess the one thing I have is this implant. This is a real thing, and it's you can take a CT scan of it, people. In fact, I'll just make a note here to drop my CT scan. I'm making a note to drop my CT scan on the image here, and so people can see it again. It is real, and it's a physical object, but I didn't see any aliens put it in. It was put in by two people. People. I could ID them immediately. I'll never forget what they looked like. Two people, a man and a woman. And there were other people around the house. I could hear them talking. Backyard. This thing is extraordinary. It is an incredible piece of technology. A piece of it has been cut off and was examined at Southwest Research and found to have be a metal base with cilia on it, motile cilia. And when the doctor tried to remove it, the reason he didn't remove the whole thing is it went from there down into the earlobe on its own. And he pulled out, of course, because he put it, I'd have to take off your whole ear. The video, by the way, is on my website somewhere, folks. So I think it's probably in the subscriber area, which reminds me that, you know, you have a lot of reasons for subscribing to Unknown Country. You probably won't, but I think you should. Okay. So, but let's go on. What do you think we should do here? Should we try to fix this in some kind of physical reality and say, yes, we know it's real? Because I think the other side of the coin is I think those bodies are at Fort Detrick. I don't know where they came from or what they are, but I think they are there. And I think that there were bodies found in Varginha in Brazil as well. And those bodies are somewhere. I don't know where. And these are physical entities. So my bottom line is, in the end, I'm going for the physical as a reality. You're not in that space, I don't think. Or are you? Where are you with that?
You mean, yes. Okay. So as to whether or not there are physical bodies, I don't know. My view, for example, of what David Grush has said is he's basically had two types of evidence. One is very authoritative people, he says, who have told him that there are, you know, physical bodies, that there's attempts to do a reverse technology. And then he said there are documents that he has seen. So of those two types of evidence, I think the most important are the documents that he claims to have seen. And so to me, it's just black and white. Either it's true or it's not true. And I think it's up to Congress to investigate his claims. And of course, I'm concerned whether Congress will truly investigate his claims, because until they do, it's just one of those he said, she said type situations. So I think it's important for Congress to, you know, find out what are the documents that Grush saw, and then go and find those documents and see what they say.
Yeah, I think that that's critical, but of course we can't do that. And Congress lacks will. We had when the Schumer amendment was gutted by the Congress, by the House, it was gutted because the head of the House Intelligence Committee had got contributions, a lot of contributions from places like Lockheed Martin. And he intentionally gutted it to help them. And I think that's probably because of the fact that there is a lot hidden behind the scenes. And if you study patent law, you find out very quickly that you can't patent something that isn't, that you haven't invented. In other words, if you find an unusual mineral that's never been discovered before, you can't patent it. It's not an invention. The problem is that they have apparently taken a lot of materials and processes that they have derived from things that they found, wreckage and so forth, and patented that, and made a great deal of money off of those patents, to the harm of companies that weren't in the know. And so you've got a massive fraud going on there, a huge amount of criminal activity, and an untenable situation. And then you add to that the fact that the defense industry, I mean, the Department of Defense, can't balance its budget and keeps losing trillions of dollars and saying publicly that a lot of its inventory can't be found. That tells me that someone sick of getting old. I've got to get younger again. Somehow we both do. In any case, Richard Dolan says that there's a breakaway civilization. And he might be right. And if you look at those missing dollars in that budget, you think to yourself, well, we're paying for the damn thing. And they're hiding it. And they're taking our money and putting it in a hole that we can't see the bottom of. It's incredible. Robert, why would taking this into academia help us?
Well, of course, I have a little bit different view. I mean, I agree with you that the Schumer amendment was gutted. And what you said is correct. The guy who gutted it, their primary source of campaign funds comes out of the defense industry. And Lockheed Martin was one of those companies. But what I don't believe that they have been able to reverse engineer any type of craft. So let's just make the assumption they have a craft or multiple crafts. Having worked in the semiconductor industry and done reverse engineering on our own type products, I know that you have to have the base technology in order to reverse engineering things. So let me give you an example. Let's say you took a modern laptop and gave it to the scientists of the year 1992. That's only 32 years ago. So you give them the schematics, everything they need. They don't even have to reverse engineer it. You just say, here, on a silver platter, here's how you make a modern laptop. The problem is they couldn't make it. And the reason they couldn't make it is they don't have the infrastructure, the scientific infrastructure to make that laptop. It doesn't matter if you told them how, right? Because today, in order to make the chips that go into that laptop, you need these photographic, we call them stepper systems, that use ultraviolet light. Well, in 1992, those did not even exist. All that existed was optical wavelengths to do that. The same is true for the metal and the metal structures that you use to make your lines that carry the current in the computer chip. Those systems did not exist in the year 1992. So, and those are just two items. There are hundreds of technologies that are required in order to build that laptop. And those technologies didn't exist in 1992. And we're talking about humans here with only 34, 40 years going by. You can imagine trying to reverse engineer a technology where you don't even understand the basic science that their technologies are built upon. So I don't think that we could effectively reverse engineer any alien technology, assuming we had a craft.
You know, my uncle Mickey was at Wright Field when the debris and the bodies were brought in from Roswell in 1947. That was where he was stationed, and in the Air Materiel Command, actually. And he witnessed this. And his friend Arthur Exon, who was later commandant of Wright Pat, also did. And they both of them talked to me pretty extensively about their experiences. After I published Communion, my uncle went so far as to get me to come down to Air Force Village at Lackland in San Antonio and just sit with him for a couple hours and talk it all out. And I could never tell. He was very careful. My uncle, in his whole career, you never really found out anything about what he did. He was attached to the Atomic Energy Commission from Air Force Intelligence for most of his career, and that was kind of all we knew. But he said some fascinating things obliquely and carefully. He said, among other things, that they had found a thing that no one understood, and that it was empty. That is to say, it was just, as I understood it, it had balsa wood framing, but the balsa wood couldn't be, nothing could be done to it any more than the very thin metal it was made of. It was just as strong, and these partitions in it made of some kind of paper that was equally impermeable. And in other words, it looked like some kind of a little toy. And yet it had contained these bodies that were there. And he didn't say this, but I've heard plenty of rumors that one of them was alive. I don't know. Nathan Twining, who was directly involved in this also, and of course, wrote the Twining memorandum. His son said that the general had talked to one of them, and it had said that they weren't interested in human beings. And I thought to myself, well, that makes sense. The first words we hear from them are their first, but not only, lie. So you know, I like to live on this shadow line, where all of this stays in question. I mean, I had my own uncle tell me these things, but I still would say that he also was describing something that a child could have made if the child had superhuman abilities to manipulate metal. So, another man, Dr. Robert Sauerbacher, told me that they had found the metal. This is 1986. I talked to him. You can look him up on the internet. Robert Sauerbacher, Sarbacher, I believe. He was involved in analyzing the Roswell debris, and he was very open about it. He didn't have a security clearance, and he just put stuff up. I mean, he wrote letters and things. Sadly enough, the day after I talked to him, he fell off of a boat and died. At least that's what the UPS guy who tried to deliver something for me to him told me. In any case, when I was talking to him, he said that they had found that the molecules of the metal were in an organized grid pattern that gave the metal incredible tensile strength, and that we could not do that. We could not manipulate atoms, which is what you would have had to do to accomplish this. And but then fast forward to an abductee who years later was lying in a hammock, and one of these little beings came up under the hammock and said, "We rearrange atoms." Can you imagine that? To an abductee explaining the Roswell metal perfectly. And if you can rearrange atoms, you're now a magician. Science is beyond, it's beyond science, it's magic. And we are just at the edge of learning how to do that. We're not far from being able to rearrange atoms. So I would like to ask you another question. And I'm sorry to be so long-winded, but I kind of have to lead these things, make this into a story. What about the future? Could the future be looking back at us through the lens of these strange eyes? And could it be that the grandfather paradox isn't triggered if they look at us through the eyes of something that doesn't exist? In other words, behind those alien faces are us from the future.
Well, that's an interesting thought, right? That perhaps they're us from the future. I mean, the main argument against it is what you mentioned, the grandfather clause, right? Can you go back in time? You do something that changes the future, and then suddenly you don't exist anymore.
Right, exactly.
So I'm not sure. That always is difficult to comprehend.
That's right. You go back into the dinosaur era, step on a flower, and we're all still Neanderthals.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
It's the butterfly effect, right?
Right.
Very small change gets magnified rapidly.
In the book, and I'm going to go off this subject because I'm having a lot of fun. You're a fun guy. You're a fascinating person to talk to because everything you say brings up all kinds of wild questions in my head. Let's take another break. So on the free side, and think of on the free side of how fun it would be if you weren't on the free side and if you were not going to be leaving us shortly. We'll be right back. We're talking to Robert Powell. His new book, UFOs, A Scientist Explains What We Know and Don't Know. I would like to ask this question. You talk about natural language processing, using it to sift through UFO reports, and I found that part of the book very, very interesting and provocative. First, can you tell us what natural language processing is, and also how it would be applied to this data set?
Sure. So natural language processing is really using words that people use in everyday language to try to discern what their true thoughts and their true actions are. So here's a good example that the audience may be more familiar with. Let's say you go into Facebook and you start using the word bomb, and you use the word plan, right? And a couple of other keywords. Well, an automated artificial intelligence system, right, that's monitoring Facebook would flag that, because they know, the system would know that anyone who uses the word bomb and plan, and let's say some other keywords such as a given date and things like that, that there's a higher likelihood that those individuals are planning something nefarious as compared to someone who's on Facebook and talks about Mother's Day and whatever, you know, other words they use. So the way you use that in the world of UFOs, for example, is you take your database of, let's say, 100,000 cases. And we know that the vast majority of those cases, 95% plus, are basically misidentifications, right? They're aircraft, they're the planet Jupiter, or the star Sirius, or what have you. So if you want to analyze the data, you need to get the basically the garbage material out of the database. So you can use natural language processing to do that. So let's say you look at your strongest cases and you say, what are the commonalities? So let's say you determine that in strong cases, the witnesses use descriptive words such as the object was, you know, 50 feet in size. It was in the constellation Orion. Words that indicate the witness is good at describing exact detail. And so you look at those type of words as compared to other reports where it's not as descriptive and it doesn't indicate that the witness is as knowledgeable, for example, of the skies as this other witness. So you use that to separate out reports. Now, will it make mistakes? Of course. You will wind up throwing out some good cases, right? But what you do, it's statistically effective, right? Because you have 100,000 cases. And so you try to overly be critical so that you can squeeze those 100,000 down to, say, 3,000. And so now you can go look for patterns. Is there a pattern? Can you discern a particular area of the country where this is more likely to happen? So that's basically what you do with natural language processing.
Okay, then give me some specific examples of, I'm sorry, I forgot to put myself back in the picture. Here, boo, folks. Anyway, give me some specific examples of how this might work with some data that you're thinking about, if that's a good question. I'm not sure.
Sure. So let's say you create basically what's called a lexicon of words. So it's like a small dictionary of, say, 1,000 words. And you notice as you compare, you know, these strong cases against what you feel are weak cases, right? You select, say, 50 strong cases and 50 weak cases. You compare those and how the words are used. And then you weight those words, right? A positive value or a negative value. And then you take that and you apply it against the entire 100,000 cases. And so then you say, okay, I want, for example, I'm going to give a positive value when a witness uses the word azimuth or elevation or direction or words that you have found in the really good cases or more often used. While in the negative words, right? A negative word might be, for example, the witness uses the word alien, right? That could be negative because that means the witness is already drawing a conclusion as they're observing. And so you're looking for witnesses that are being just more factual and are not prejudiced in any direction. Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you, I want to ask you a question about a specific data set, which is the communion letters that are on file at Rice University. There's thousands of them. and they're being digitized. And I'm going to ask you in a minute exactly what you think we should do with that data once it's available in a digital format. But before I do that, free Dreamlanders, I got to say goodbye. It's time to say goodbye. We'll be back again next week, as always. And I can assure you the show will be as fascinating next week as it was this week, and maybe more so, who knows. Thanks very much for being with us on Dreamland. We're talking to Robert Powell. His new book, UFOs. What's the subtitle again? Hit me.
A scientist explains what we know and don't know.
Right, and don't know. Okay, well, let's get to this data set. This is, say, it's 10 or 15,000 letters at least. And they all describe very, very often very, very different experiences. And these are all people who were moved to sit down and write a letter to an author because their experience had such was burning inside them and had been there for usually for years, usually. The letters are mostly written in the late 80s and about experiences that generally happened between 1952 and 1983 or 4. What about that kind of a data set, which has, must have an enormous variety of different words to describe these impossible experiences? Would it be possible to apply natural language processing principles to such a data set?
Yeah, absolutely. You would have a different set of rules for that than what I was just describing. But if what you would first want to do is put together a team of individuals that were knowledgeable of what you were trying to attempt, right? And so, because you need to be able to say, okay, these are the type of reports that we believe are more likely to be valid. And these are the type of reports that we feel what's being reported is perhaps a psychological issue rather than an actual occurrence, right? So you need to have this group of three or four people that discern that difference. And then once you've done that, then you create this lexicon of words and giving them positive and negative values based on some key letters that you have evaluated and that you're trying to identify similar situations in, say, this other database that you've got, right? And so I think you could definitely use natural language processing in evaluating those letters and trying to find other letters or other information that's similar. Does that kind
okay.
of make sense?
Yeah, that makes some sense. I just wonder, you know, it would be interesting if we were able to find patterns of language. What about AI and the application, because what you're going to deal with here is a lot of variable language. But the reason being that people are all trying to describe something that they've basically never seen before. And they're all going to be using the language in their own very personal way for the most part. And what about the application of artificial intelligence to do things like, see if it can find similarities in ideas and concepts, even though the language is not the same. Would that work?
Yes, you could do that also. And because natural language processing, in a way, is artificial intelligence that you're using.
Right, right.
And you're creating algorithms that are going to go search for what you're looking for. So you could do the same thing. By looking at word concepts rather than just the words. It's a little more complicated to look for concepts than individual words. but yes, exactly. It can be done.
Well, I hope that the digitization happens because it's costly. And, you know, one of the things about abduction research, you think UFO research is underfunded. Try abduction research. I'm a major funding source for abduction research, and I usually have about $500 maybe to spare. So, it, you know, nobody wants to grant in any of this area. Let me ask you this. You probably know the answer. There is no granting in UFO research. No foundation grants. How could that change? Could there be a situation in which granting becomes more possible? I know there's a little bit going on, but not the kind of big granting we really need.
Right. You're right, Whitley. There's a little bit, but there's nothing significant. So what really needs to happen, and this is what I point out in the book, is that Congress really needs to allocate funding specifically for UAP or UFO research, right? And so that funding needs to be distributed by the National Science Foundation, but Congress needs to say, okay, X amount of dollars must go for UAP or UFO-related research. Now, the National Science Foundation can decide, you know, who they want to give the various grants to, but Congress really needs to specify that X amount of dollars must go to UAP and not just general science.
Well, that gets back to the Defense Department, who will have a say in exactly where that money goes when the National Science Foundation is going to distribute it. And you may be sure that it's not going to go in any useful direction if the Defense Department has anything to say about it, which it will. The FBI is researching abductions right now. They are quietly going to abductees and close encounter witnesses and asking to investigate their cases. Now, I have talked about this a few times because it is clear to me there is absolutely no question that the object of this research is to produce a report that will go out into all of the usual sources, the New York Times, NPR, CNN, all of the places where this rubbish lands routinely, The Guardian in England is another big source, saying that the FBI has investigated it and we have concluded there were no abductions. That's the purpose of it, and the only purpose. And how do we deal with things like that? Like, there's nothing in the public space about this. I know about it because it's my job to know about things like that. And all I can do is warn people, don't talk to them. But that won't help because I also know how the FBI operates and I know how they're trained. And one of the things they're trained to do is to basically be appealing and friendly. They're very good at being nice when they're screwing you to the wall. And they're like CIA officers. They're trained in this. And so these people are innocent. People are going to be talked to by these guys who are going to be very enthusiastic and very, oh, really, and forthcoming. And the report is going to say it's all nonsense. That's its purpose. What do we do with that in the UFO community?
Well, of course, I have not heard what that the FBI is investigating abductions, but I'll take your word for that because that, like I said, that's not the area that I, my area of expertise. I think the only thing that you can really do with this, whether it's related to abductions or UFO, the topic at large, is that you just have to keep chipping away at the brick wall and getting papers accepted into academia and, convincing more and more people that this is a valid subject that needs to be seriously investigated using the scientific method. And I guess to give you a little feeling of hope that will happen in the future is like SCU, the organization that I'm on the board of directors.
Oh, that's right. The Scientific Coalition of UAP Studies is what he's talking about. Folks. Right. Go ahead, tell us about that.
So that organization was created in 2017. And our mission is basically the scientific investigation of UAP. Well, today, and this has only been less than 7 years later, we now have over 300 members. And of those 300 members, 30% have PhDs, over half have advanced degrees. And the importance there is not, you know, to say, okay, we've got all these great members. The importance is that it tells people that the scientific community is interested in this subject. That's why they've joined the SCU. So that's a lot different than 30 and 40 years ago, where J. Allen Hynek had to have his, quote, invisible university of guys that, you know, got together and talked about the science behind UFOs, but they never allowed their names to be put out in public. So that's not a problem in our membership. So I think things are changing slowly but surely.
Well, it's exciting that I agree with you. Things are changing. And I was at the Soul Foundation conference a few months ago in Palo Alto. In Palo Alto, that Gary, Peter Skafish and Gary Nolan organized. And it was really a very good conference. There were a lot of big names there, heavy hitters, and a lot of scientists and so forth in the audience. Only one person was not presenting. You're looking at him, me. And if there's anyone in the world who should have been presenting on the abduction subject at a conference like that, it was me. And I said to Gary, I said, you know, what I did was I went up to the conference and I asked questions from the floor. And I pointed out that this community wasn't represented. And this community, of course, is the bedrock of everything, because what's happening to people is what really matters here in the end. And he said that if I had been on the program, a lot of the members of the people who had come would not have been there. I found that fascinating. They wouldn't have come. Now, how do we, you know, it's heartening to see that UAP studies are beginning to gain some serious scientific validity. But what about us? Will we ever be included in, allowed to sit at the table? Because in the end, we're what matters, aren't we?
Right. I think so, Whitley. But I do think it's a slow process. But just look at where we're at today. As you just mentioned, you have the Soul Foundation, which was recently created. You have the Galileo Project, which is only 2 to 3 years old. And then you have SCU, which is 6 to 7 years old. I mean, 30 years ago, can you imagine there having been three organizations that have scientific members as part of those organizations? So that's the plus part. The part, you know, that needs to continue to get better is it's what you were just referring to. And we've actually brought this up within SCU members, is that we would like, for example, some of our PhDs that have PhDs in sociology and psychology and statistics and other areas to do a scientific study on the abduction phenomenon, right? Now, and to do that, right, you begin by saying the first thing you have to dispel is whether or not there's any psychological issue to it, right? So you do that by saying, okay, here is a typical psychological profile of, you know, the American public. And here's a typical other typical profiles. Here are the profiles of abductees. And then if an abductee profile, right, is typical of anyone in America, then that tells you, well, it doesn't appear to be a psychological issue, right? There must be some type of validity behind it. Then you can begin to look at, okay, are there any type of qualities that could identify why some people have abductee experiences while other people do not? You know, what are those qualities? Whether that quality is a mental quality, an emotional quality, a physical quality, or any other type of quality. And that's how science works, right? You have to get the data together and then begin to examine it. And you don't presuppose the answer before you finish your work. So, you know, you have to be open to all possibilities, which means you're open to the possibility that it's real. You're open to the possibility that it is something that perhaps is put into people's heads. And you're open to the possibility that it's purely a psychological issue. So you have to be open to all possibilities, and then you gather the data, and then you go where the data takes you.
Yeah, exactly. And this could happen. Right? This is a real thing. It absolutely could happen.
Yeah,
and all it takes is money. I think the people are ready to do it.
Right. It does take money, because like what I just described, that can't be cheaply done. I mean, you have to have some guys that are full time working on that. Right.
Right. And exactly. It's not cheap. And there are the other things that can be done. Like I've only seen one paper on it, but there is apparently a methodology using functional MRI scanning that can determine whether or not a memory is an unintentional confabulation, in other words, imaginary, or that it results from stimulation of the sensory system, in other words, sense, scent, and touch, and vision, and hearing, and so forth, and also within an individual memory, it can get to the point where it can determine what parts of that memory are confabulated and what parts are result of physical experience. Now, I'm telling you this right now without question, doing even a small study like that of these people would A, be probably incredibly enlightening, and B, terribly expensive.
And, you know, just what you just mentioned, right? So you need a neuroscientist on your team also that's doing this work, right?
Right.
The cost of doing a large number of MRIs, right?
Because, well, not just MRIs, but functional MRIs, which are even more expensive.
Yeah.
You know, so, and a good neurologist who's able to do this. And, you know, there's probably not too many people who can.
Right.
I think that the first place you'd go would be to the authors of that paper. And where is it now? I mean, I haven't seen a lot done on it. Of course, the problem being that screams intelligence community, because they're always looking for ways of determining whether or not a person is lying. And you know, lie detectors are an indifferent and very irregular mechanism. They don't work very well. They're not very reliable. And it could be that this has disappeared into the classified world. And like so much else, you know how to revolutionize this planet and to change everything and to bring about a truly new world? To make classification illegal and to end it all, to simply end it. Then we would have the most extraordinary scientific revolution in the history of mankind, exceeding even the Renaissance and the Enlightenment.
You know, you might have a point there. Of course, you know, the counter argument is going to be national security concerns.
Bullshit. I'm sorry.
But if you set those aside and you eliminated all this classification, I mean, there is a lot of scientific information that's not available to scientists because it's classified.
That's correct.
Not just in the United States, but all countries.
I just had breakfast a couple of weeks ago with Hal Puthoff, who has been a friend for many, many years, and he struggles at the edge of the you know, he's got a clearance, and so, and he part of what he does is inside and part of it is outside. And he would like the twain to meet because, you know, his income, you know, everything, his economic life would be profoundly affected if a lot of the things that he's worked on the inside could be on the outside where he could be compensated for them fairly. I mean, he's never said that, but I'm guessing that's true. And that's probably true of all people in the who are tangled up in this mess. He said that there's nothing, he didn't say this a couple of weeks ago, but a few years ago, he said there's absolutely nothing that chills a scientist more than the fear of going to his lab one morning and finding it padlocked by the intelligence community and that his work has now been classified and him along with it. Because then you're out of circulation. You're no longer, you have no career. You're inside in a kind of frozen world.
Yeah, the government can, for example, take your patents. If you have a patent and it's deemed to be national security, they can remove it and take control of that patent. So it's,
well, I think it's out of control. It's what's happened. I know that way back when Claiborne Pell and others were on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, they had their counsel start grilling me because I published Majestic, which contains details about the Roswell incident, which were all true. It's a work of fiction, and the truth is mixed in with the fiction. And they wanted to know where I found all this stuff out. And in the process of that, I ended up in a situation where someone in the intelligence community decided I was an alien in disguise. I'm serious. And I was living in a little street in Brooklyn Heights called Grace Court, which was a block long. And all of a sudden, one morning, Grace Court's filled up with these cars, with these guys sitting in these cars, with staring straight ahead. And I thought, holy God, what in the, now what? And I called a detective to see, and he came over, and he said, take a look. And he said, all those are all official cars. They're from the federal government. I can tell by the license numbers. And so I called the guy at the Senate whose name I hope to remember in a minute. And I said to him that this was happening. He says, I'll get them to leave. And 10 minutes later, they all drive away. I called him back. I said, what the hell's going on? He said, Whitley, did you send some kind of a note on your computer saying that you were an alien? I said, of course not. He said, because the NSA can read what's your rating on a computer from an office in the top of the World Trade Center, which you can see from our apartment. I said, well, no, I might well have been writing fiction about that, but it's called fiction for a reason. Can you imagine the stupidity? I'm mind-boggling. And I bring this story up because what we're going to find, if we ever get that door, that big, heavy door open, is not only a lot of interesting stuff, but a lot of tomfool nonsense, just like that. Unless I am an alien and they know it and I don't. What do you think of that? What do you think? How can we get out of this trap, Robert? You tell it. You've got a brilliant book here that discusses all kinds of fascinating things about this, and you get into this the need for congressional support. Where do we get that support if one guy on the Senate's on the House Intelligence Committee can torpedo something as important as the Schumer Amendment, all the critical parts of it, simply because of he gets contributions from Lockheed and friends?
Yeah, that's it's surprising how the government works, that you could have an amendment like that, and then it gets changed in a subcommittee, right? And the way what happens, of course, is you have that change, but it's tied in with the National Defense Authorization Act, right? So if you're going to, if the Senate was going to say, hold on, guys, we don't want that cut. Well, now you have to send it back, which means you delay your National Defense Authorization Act, right? So, and that's considered, you know, untenable, right? Because we have to have our defense budget. So it's, it's a interesting political game is on, not just on the question of UFOs, but just on anything when you try to move legislation through Congress.
Right. And you have these companies which would be fighting for their lives if the truth was known, for the reasons I described earlier. But maybe there's another factor. We haven't talked about the strangeness factor. Maybe somebody back in there somewhere with unusual powers and abilities doesn't want this stuff out. Could that be the case?
That's an interesting question. You know, is there someone, in the back hall somewhere that doesn't want this information to get out?
Someone with big black eyes.
Yeah. And you know, I'm torn a lot between government hiding information versus government just being stupid and not aware of things.
Yeah.
Versus someone in the background, right, pulling the strings. And I never know which of those three is the dominant driver of things that happen sometimes.
Let's get specific about what you think Congress needs to do besides funding. I mean, what to get to funding, there's a lot that has to be done before then.
Well, bless you. What basically all Congress needs to do is, like in a rider such as the National Defense Authorization Act, put in $100 million, right, that is to be earmarked towards the study of UAP, and that it will be given to scientific organizations as well as academic organizations. And once that's earmarked, here's an example that's similar. Global warming, right? There's no such thing as a degree in global warming, just like you'll never have a degree in UAP. But both of those require knowledge from many different academic areas: physics, chemistry, biology, the environment. So that's what we've done with global warming, right? There's been money appropriated for the study of that. And the same thing Congress can do in the study of UFOs or UAP is that same type of mechanism. So I actually don't think it's difficult to do. I think it's just a willpower question. Is Congress willing to appropriate, you know, that funding? And are they willing to insist that it be done, right? And they don't allow, for example, the defense industry to cut something out. I think it has a good chance of making it through because it's not a specific item, right? Like one thing that got gutted out of the Schumer Amendment was to have a civilian organization that worked with AARO, the military, right? So that got gutted out. But that's a specific thing that's kind of a threat, right? But if you just say funding, right, and you're just talking about raw dollars, and then you leave it to the scientific community and academia to decide where those raw dollars will be spent, then you don't have to fight as much with the defense establishment on specific things.
Yeah, so you have you end up in a situation where it kind of can. If you don't use a strainer, you can get it through. In other words,
right. Exactly. Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah,
right.
If you don't use the strainer, you can get it through.
Okay, I want to ask, we're getting up toward the end of the show, amazingly. It's hard to believe that much time has passed. It's been such a fun, interesting conversation. At least I thought so. So, now, you mentioned quite a few discoveries and in insights in the book. What is one of the most surprising things to you in what you have, all this enormous amount of research you've done?
So one
what
of
stands the, out?
Something that's, well, I'm going to kind of answer that in two ways. One thing that stands out, which I really emphasize in this book, and that is objects in our atmosphere that are capable of accelerating at rates of 10, 100, and even 1,000 G-forces. To give you a feel for that, one G-force is what you feel in your chair right now. That's one G-force. Take an F-35, our most modern jet. If it accelerates, the most it can accelerate linearly, just straight ahead, and generate is about 1.5 G-forces. An SR-71 is able to generate a little more than 2 G-forces, right? Other than now, if you turn the craft like an F-18, right, and you turn just like you're in a roller coaster, you can generate 8 or 9 G-forces because of the what you would call angular acceleration. So, but the thing that's important here is that we have sufficient evidence in my mind, both from radar and from a myriad number of very qualified witnesses, that we have objects in our atmosphere that can accelerate linearly, in a linear fashion, straight ahead, faster than anything that's humanly made, short of someone firing a artillery round, right, or an ACBM or an ABM missile, right? But those objects are fire, you launch and forget. It's not something that stops later on. So they're not aircraft, per se. But aircraft, we can't do that. Okay, so that's one thing that really stands out. The other thing that stood out for me when I wrote the book, and it came to me as I wrote it, is scientists, for example, in my field in chemistry, science is very repeatable. And scientists often want to know, why can't I repeat? I want to be able to repeat this. If this UFO sends me a signal at 2.5 hertz, then if you see it, you need to be able to measure that it sends a signal at 2.5 hertz, right? Well, that sounds good when you're in the worlds of physics and chemistry. But as you move out of those worlds into the worlds of biology and sociology and psychology, things are not so repeatable. And why is that? Well, think about it. If you're not dealing with a life form, or in other words, an intelligence, it's easier to repeat what your experiment happens to be. But as you start to deal, for example, with a pack of dogs, I could do an experiment with a pack of dogs, and they may react totally differently to me than if you ran that same experiment, right? Use the same food, everything. You may not get the same reaction. And if you move that up to humans, right, it's even worse. Right. If you cuss at a human being and you cuss at 100 different human beings, you may very well get 100 different reactions or close to it. So imagine, make the supposition that you are dealing with something far more intelligent than us. So at that point in time, you have to say, I can't expect to be able to repeat an experiment. Right. And as a matter of fact, the more you think about it, you have to wonder whether you're running the experiment or the more intelligent species is running the experiment. And that's what kind of really blew my mind as I started thinking about that as I wrote the book, is we could be the experiment rather than us trying to say, how come I can't repeat this experiment? So that was an interesting part I had in the book, I think, Whitley.
Well, I think that's an interesting place to conclude, and with a reminder that we never perceive anything directly. We only can obtain information through our senses. Our eyes, nose, touch, all of those senses, ears. There is a book called The Idea of the World, which argues that we don't know what's out there and can't know. We can only know what our senses are telling us. And if we're dealing with a higher intelligence, it may be that it could be doing anything with us. It could be running an experiment. We could always also be an energy source. And when I say energy source, it may be that our emotions are energy at another level of reality. We just don't know. And that's where I think we're going to conclude today about UFOs, What We Know and Don't Know, by Robert Powell, a really wonderful journey down the rabbit hole and farther than that. Thank you so much for being with us, Robert, on Dreamland. It was an absolute delight to have you.
Thank you, Whitley. I enjoyed the conversation. As usual, it's great.
Yeah, it was sure fun. Okay. Well, next week, folks, we will be back with, I don't know what's on schedule for next week. I hope we will be back. And anyway, so be well. And Robert, thank you so much.
Thanks, Whitley.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.